Hiram Drockey received his M.A. degree from Gustavus Adolphus College and Ph.D. from the University of North Dakota. He's been a professor of European and economic history at Concordia College in Moorhead since 1952. Although he has a doctorate degree, he is seldom addressed as doctor. People who know him address him affectionately as Hi. Drockey operates a totally automated confined cattle feedlot operation in Baker, Minnesota, and serves as a consultant to agribusiness firms and farmers throughout the Midwest. He's been researching and writing about agriculture and regional history since the mid-1950s. His books include The Day of the Bonanza, The Challenge of the Prairie, as well as contributing to North Dakota Decision Makers, a book about North Dakota government, and he was one of 19 authors selected to write the bicentennial offering, 200 Years of American Agriculture. Two new books soon to be available are Beyond the Furrow and Tomorrow's Harvest. A man with seemingly endless energy, as you will soon discover by listening to him, Hiram Drockey also serves on the Minnesota Humanities Commission and is a council member of the Minnesota Historical Society. The title of his talk before the participants in this conference on rural America was Agriculture in the Year 2000. Hiram Drockey.
I suspect that this will be the most unpopular talk of this conference. In some respects, I hope it is. On the way up here, I was thinking about how I was going to say it, because as I heard a couple of people say, well, you know, it's easy for us to give the answers because we don't know anything about it. Sort of reminds me of a lot of environmentalists I listen to and a lot of Impreg kids and a lot of other things that are doing jobs around the nation today. They got all the answers because they don't know anything about it. And so understand, and don't throw tomatoes at me, don't throw glass at me, because I know that some of you aren't going to like what I got to say. Yesterday I was speaking at Houston, Texas, at the presidents of the Texas PCA. And they said, why don't you tell us something new? Because I just made a speech to them on agriculture is the great capital and management intense industry of today. The capital and management intense industry. And Bill Hugh told you today, you better look for money someplace else, and yet we got guys fighting people who want to come in and bring corporate money into American agriculture. See, where are you going to get it from? North Dakota sends all of its money out because they keep the interest law rates down in the state. This is the kind of thing that happens. This is no longer the good old days when the kids didn't have shoes, when dad didn't make a go of it on the farm, and when the wife didn't get a flush toilet, or didn't get a new suit, or a new coat, or something else, because Pa couldn't make the payments on the farm. There is nobody going to do that anymore, because the kids walk away from the farm the minute they get out of high school. Because so many of you want to perpetuate the good old homestead. And I'm afraid there's some of you in the crowd here that got some influence on that are trying to do that very thing. And it really bothers me that this has happened. The good old days when 70% of the capital in agriculture was generated on the farm by the blood, sweat, and tears and the toil of the family. The good old days when that happened. 70% of all capital generated in agriculture up till 1950 was generated right on the farms, on the sweat of the children and the wives. No wonder 8 out of 11 kids in the Protesfield family left the farm as soon as they could. And do you bankers better wake up to that? You're going to keep them on the farm, you better finance them. And that's exactly what has to be done. But don't get too concerned about me if you don't like what I've got to say, because I'm just a dumb farmer, a plow jockey, a hick, or a hayseed. How many of you guys were that, Walter? You were in your day, I was in my day, and 25 years after I graduated from high school in Old Town of Minnesota, I got up and reminded them of the fact that here was a hick, a plow jockey, a hayseed, and a dumb farmer. And why? Because that's where we put a lot of people in the old days. Any good hired man could become a farmer. Any good hired man could become a farmer. Well, how many million are you going to loan him to start farming, or a quarter of a million? How much are you going to do? And yet farmers don't feel sorry for yourselves because you got the biggest club that anybody in America's got. Because first of all, you own the choice collateral, land. Secondly, three times a day they got to come to you because their guts are empty and they want to eat. And third, we are the dollar savers because we are the only industry that is unrestricted by over-legislation or by intensive unions that we have the free enterprise to do what we will want to do yet. Because even though agriculture has been one of the most poorly managed industries, the free enterprise system of the good innovative farmers has made America the great industrial power that we are, because 75% of the cash exports of this country for over a century came right off the land. Where would we be? Where would the American dollar be if it hadn't been for that surplus of about $12 billion worth of agriculture products? And yet there are a lot of you people right in this crowd, I'm sure, that want to saddle that innovative, creative, progressive, challenging agriculture that we've had, because too many of you want to keep the good old days. Well, read Challenge about the good old days, and if you don't believe Challenge, read Giants in the Earth and find out about all the insane people who never made a decent living on it. Okay, that's sort of the sermon, but I want you to remember something. I want you to remember, I am a family-oriented farmer, and I do not believe that there is a single thing in this country outside of legislation that can destroy the hold that the family-oriented farm has on rural America. I am absolutely convinced of that, and I'm going to tell you why in just a minute. These are not exploiters of the land I'm talking about. I'm talking about good conservation-oriented farmers who've got the money and the know-how to save the soil for posterity. Midwest agriculture, the year 2000. Where are we today and where are we headed? Iowa, Minnesota have the greatest farm population of the 50 states. North Dakota and South Dakota have the highest percentage of farm population of the 50 states. And yet it is clear that the farm of the Jeffersonian agrarian myth is nowhere to be found. Yes, nowhere to be found except in the minds of individuals. The farm of the Jeffersonian agrarian myth, if you aren't sure of it, it's that little 160-acre farm with 10th grade education and everybody could starve to death equally. You see? Putting down the line, Ellingson, aren't I? Everybody could starve to death equally, including the consumers. In 1973, the United States Department of Agriculture made a study. And the Department of Agriculture is always super conservative. I have never seen when their figures have not been. And in that study, they pointed out what the optimum one-man family farm was. What the optimum-sized one-man family farm. Dick Fitzsimons doing it all by himself. Here's what it was. The optimum row crop farm was 800 acres. That's what one man with a good set of machinery could do with corn or soybeans. And what did they point out? The average-sized row crop farm in America was 263 acres. And then they pointed out that the optimum-sized one-man wheat farm was 1,950 acres. But the figures showed that the average-sized wheat farm was 694 acres. What am I saying in both cases? The average-sized farm today is one-third the size of what the USDA says the average, well-mechanized one man can do. Where are we going with the farms? Well, the figures ought to tell you where we're going to go, because the bankers around here are not going to finance the guy who can't make a living farming, unless his wife wants to work full-time in town and bring the money home. That's another point. Don't forget that. Unless his wife wants to work full-time in town to support that lovely little 4-H club project. And we've got a lot of those. We're going to have more of them. All right, what else do we know? In 1910, the average size farm in America was 310 acres. Today, it's 391 acres. Does any of you have to guess anymore? Where are we going? We have more than tripled the size of farm in the last 60 years, and we ain't done yet. No, we're not. We got a long ways to go. And then you look at something else. With this industry that has an asset to debt ratio of 5.5 to 1, you think we're going to stop when the farmers today have about 17 cents in debts to every 100 pennies they own? They're not about to stop. Now, that may be disproportionately distributed. It may be that the guy who's operating a little more efficiently has got a better leverage, or he may be better in debt and know how to leverage better one way or another. But it tells you that barring some kind of major change in the free enterprise system, and I got a scare about that one, barring some major change in the free enterprise system, we will continue to have larger family-oriented farms in America. Always remember how I'm saying this. I'm not talking about mythical corporate giants. So much hogwash. On the opposite side, there is not likely to be much of a decline in total farm numbers. Oh, I sound like I'm talking out of both sides of the mouth. No, I'm not a politician. What am I saying? All of you know that there is a very strong effort on the part of people today to want to move to the country and have 40 acres and 2 sheep and a pony. And as long as they have a full-time industrial job and carry that union card and the dinner pail to work every morning, they can continue to support that little project. Because maybe they don't like a cabin at the lake. Maybe they like having chickens. And I'm predicting then that there will be a long, long time before we will get rid of about 2 million of these little hobby farmers. But let's not include them with the man who provides the meal that we ate today. He's in a totally different position. But too many people try to tie together. And how do I find this out? Because I find out that these are the strongest competitors for land in the rural areas today, any place near an industrial town. This is what we're up against. Now, a quick survey of figures tell you this, because you know that the top two brackets in the census figures are growing. The 1 and 2 size farms, 40,000 gross and 100,000 gross. So you got to get up in that bigger bracket so there's better income. What's happened to the 3, 4, and 5 class farms? They've either moved up or they've taken a job in town like my two brother-in-laws have and have never lived better than ever, because they never could make a go of it farming. No, I own their land. No. You see? Or you want to move yourself into that other spot. You want to move yourself into that class 6 farm where the people with the figures know is really almost swelling. That 1-point-some-million farmers who are less than $2,500 gross income a year. And I'll tell you, people, that's their right. If they want to have a hobby, they are entitled to it. They're entitled to it because they have to pay the cost. One man called me the other day, and he said, I got some sheep for my kids. He said, I know it's a money-losing proposition. And I said, John, how much value do you place on therapy? That's the answer. These are not farmers now. Let's stop kidding ourselves, and let's stop ranting and appealing to these particular people with all kinds of legislation. Now, the size of farm has always been an antagonistic problem in American history. I'm just finishing a book by John Schlebecker, who is the curator of the Smithsonian Institute, good friend of mine. And John said, we did a wonderful job of distributing the land in this country, quite by accident. Quite by accident. And part of that wonderful job was the Homestead Act, which made more people suffer voluntarily than any act I know. Because you know and I know that 90% of the farms in a rich, fat county like Cass County, North Dakota, failed. And they were given to the people because they couldn't endure the price of a free farm. And that's exactly what it amounted to. They couldn't endure that farm that was given to them. And yet we are perpetuating that type of myth among agricultural historians and a lot of other people. Now, I have prepared two books, as you know, that are coming out within the next year on this type of agriculture. And what am I going to say? It is my conclusion that from 1910 to the present time, with the exception of some major technological breakthrough, there has been no other external force that has hastened the growth of large-scale farms than the government programs. And who sold it? The politicians. Who did he sell it to? The 80% of the farmers down here who are getting less than $5,000 payment a year. Yes, their average was $387. And they voted for it. And who reaped the profits? The 20% who got more than $5,000 a year in payments. And I know enough of you farmers in the crowd here that you know what I'm talking about is true. And so I ask one of them, what did you do with that government payment every year? Well, I bought my neighbors out. You see? And every year they pounded it home. How do I know this? Because read the Schapmeyer brothers' two volumes on Henry Wallace. Henry Wallace, the Republican Secretary of Agriculture for the Democrat Franklin Roosevelt. So pin it where you want it. Pin it where you want it. All right, and what did Henry Wallace say in 1934 when he wrote it? He said, the one thing that disturbs me most about these programs, and I have talked at great length with the Schapmeyer brothers on this, the one thing that disturbs me more than anything about these programs is that they are going to hasten the demise of the small farm. Because the built-in guarantees of the government payments are going to be penciled in to the economics. And the smart operator is going to take advantage of it. And so a lot of smart operators threw away their philosophy and their emotions and went to the pocketbook. Machiavelli tells you about that. And they bought out their neighbors. And now we wonder what's happened to all these little farms. Why? The government got what it wanted. What did the government want? I want a viable agriculture that could give America cheap food at 16.5% of take-home pay. The cheap food policy in the Homestead Act, the cheap food policy in the Land-Grant College Act, the cheap food policy in the Extension Service, the cheap food policy in REA, the cheap food policy in RTA. All of it has been brought about to improve the life that Father was praying about here, that farmers could have, but also so the farmers could do a better job of producing low-cost food. You bet your boots, and we aren't done yet. And I don't care who's president of the United States, there is no president that can withstand the onslaught of 98% of the people who only think of cheap food. And that's exactly where we are in rural America today. And Lauren, you know that as well as I do, because everybody wants to eat as cheaply as possible. I'm talking to farmers here when I'm addressing some of these people, and they know what the problem is. They want to eat cheaply, and I don't blame them. Because there's all these other nice things to buy and trips to go on. And the less you have to pay for food, the more money you got for the wants of life. And so the food stamp program, you know, is a great thing. And if all of us had it, we'd still complain because we had to go after the stamps. Henry Wallace, who personally liked to think of himself as the father of industrialized agriculture. That was his great dream. Quote who? His daughter, Mrs. Douglas. Talked to her about 2 years ago in Washington, D.C. And he sold it. He sold it. And we got a viable agriculture. Now we got a basic group of farmers in this country who are well-managed, well-financed, good businessmen, with innovative, challenging outlooks towards the future. And there are some other government programs that are going to make a difference. Government programs, OSHA backed off a little bit now, which is going to help, but environmental regulations, social and labor legislation, which will all further have a greater impact on the small farmer than the big farmer. Why? Because generally, the small, independent farmer is just that. small and independent. And he likes it that way. But he isn't going to put up with all that rot gut from Washington or St. Paul or Bismarck. He doesn't like that. That's why he's out there in the farm. He wants to be left alone. When Daniel Boone heard buckshot, he went away. He didn't want to hear the gunshot of his neighbors. And these people are that way to a great degree yet. These are the same guys who don't want a hired man around. They don't want to put up with a guy who only wants to work two-thirds of the time that he's on the payroll, but draw full pay. That's the kind of man he is. And this is great. Now let's go back and talk about who are these big farmers. In 1929, the USDA took a study. And in that time, they found out there were 7,000 farms in the country, 7,875 exactly, that had more than $30,000 gross income. That was a big farm, man alive. 30,000 gross income, 7,875 farms. And what did they prove in the 1929 USDA study? These farms are more efficient in land, labor, and capital than are the smaller farms. Then in 1964, we had another one. This is Orville Freeman, was secretary at that time, and conducted another one. 1964, Norbert can verify these, they decided to go up to $100,000. Why? Inflation, I suppose. $100,000 minimum to be called at a large farmer. They found out there were 31,401 farms that had $100,000 gross income at that time. They produced 24% of the total, production on 1% of the farms. Okay, where are we now? Today, we have 109,000 farms that produce more than $100,000 in gross income. And I can look at some right around here and see them, and I don't have to look very far. 109,000 farms that produce more than $100,000 in gross income. 4% of all farms in America that produce 46.5% of all our produce. They're the guy everybody hates but the consumer. Nobody likes a big farmer but the consumer. That's why we've gone to 4 car makers, because we've driven all the little inefficient ones out of business. And when Lyndon Johnson said in 1965, and I know as Dr. Hugh was at the conference at Morris, Minnesota, and Jimmy Hillman got up and he said, there's nothing the matter with agriculture today. For the top million farmers. And then he said, but there happen to be 3.1 million farmers in America today. And he said, you know why we know that? The top million are doing okay? Their income tax returns prove it. And they just about butchered Lyndon Johnson when he made that statement, didn't they? And yet it was a very honest, level-headed statement. 1 million farmers could do the job. Why? Because Sherwood Berg's committee had proven and established that that was the case. And that's the Food and Fiber Committee of Lyndon Johnson. You can read all the material just like I have if you want to find out about it. So here we are, 100,000 farms supplying us with 46.5% of our total food and fiber. And you know what else they find out? The guys that are running these farms are well-educated kids. Just like I found out, most of them have master's degrees. And then Krauss and Kyle come along and they find out, and make an intensive study throughout the Midwest, and found out in the period from 1968 to 1970 that as far as they were concerned, the farmers who were operating on a fairly good scale saw no upper limit. You know what the biggest restriction was? Narrow bridges on the township roads so they couldn't get their machinery through. Now we got them so we can fold them up 5 times. Yes, disc and field cultivators and things like that, we can fold them up 5 times. I have seen it, and some of you have too, I'm sure, so we can get through. And what else did they point out? They pointed out that the man is operating on a little bigger than average scale, is saving $10 to $13 an acre in purchased inputs, and he is selling at $5 or $6 more per acre than the farmer on a smaller scale. Why? Because he's dialing up Duluth, Minnesota, and saying, what's the price at the terminal for his grain? And he's getting it. And he's dialing up his wholesalers. And the wholesalers are coming to him. The wholesalers are coming to him because many of them are buying more than the total volume of the local elevators. I know I have had it told to me by both wholesalers and farmers and elevator managers, by all three. They come to you You don't go to them, and they offer you that. Well, what am I saying? Some of you aren't smiling. And I'm saying this. There is a greater revolution taking place in rural America than 95% of the people living here are even grasping. There's a greater revolution taking place in rural America than 95% of the people in rural America are even grasping. It's happening so fast. If some of you read the June-July Farm Journal article on me, where I said, let us alone and we'll produce the food, I had people from both coasts and from all over the Midwest comment on it, and pretty intelligently. Mr. Black of the Farm Journal said the same. He said, there weren't too many critics. I said, I don't think they want to take too many shots. And I had one man tell me, he said, hi, I know you're right, and I'm glad that I'm old enough so it isn't affecting me. Now, where are these farms, and what did I discover? I discovered that the farms that I interviewed in five states in Manitoba, you want to know the states? Iowa, the two Dakotas, Minnesota, Montana, and Manitoba, are 25 times the average size farm in America today. I heard a gentleman, he's taking a note right now, talking ahead of me in the chow line. And he said, I think that 2,500 acres seems to be the upper limit for a lot of people. And I agreed with the other comment he said, because this seems to be the level of their management ability. But I know people who aren't satisfied and who've got capacity, because I could take most of the farmers that I interviewed, I could put a blindfold on them, and I could take them to Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, and I could set them down in the chair of a big factory. And I'd say, here, you got 30 days to take over this factory. And you know what? They could all do it. Are they dumb farmers, plow jockeys, hayseeds, hicks? No, they're Waller Rosses and Lauren Hilliers and Cliff Hagans and a lot of other ones around here. They're the kind of guys that can do what they want to do. The challenge is the thing. The challenge is the thing. This is it. Texas PCEA yesterday, you know what I projected to them? I said, in 5 years, your loan average will double. At 72,000 now, it'll double in 5 years. And somebody said to me, the president of Texas PCEA said to me, did you know our figures? And I said, no. He said, that's exactly what our projections are. They expect that the average loan will be $150,000 instead of $72,000. That's at PCEA. And their top loan right now is $8 million to a single farmer. And they like him because he's got a wife who is a really good manager. That's one of the five M's of agriculture. Let's go on with this. What else did I find out? These are the men who are knocking at the doors at Versatile and at Steiger and at John Deere. And they're saying, when are you going to come out with that bigger tractor? You mean the 325 horsepower is not big enough? No, no. That's why there's a six-wheel drive, 750 horsepower tractor working about 50 miles west of the Red River right now. And you know who wants to buy it? The man who wants to have a family farm, and he is going to buy that tractor rather than have two smaller ones and have a hired man. The same kind of guys that too many of our state legislatures want to legislate right out of business. That's right. And this is what's going on. What did I find out on these farms? The average tractor in America on the farms operates 68 acres. But on the farms that I interviewed, the average tractor was tilling 594 acres. Now, who do you suppose is getting the most out of his tractor? The guy with 68 acres tillable land average, or the guy with 594 acres average? It's obvious. Why, if Father wasn't such a good friend, I could say even a minister could figure out the economics of that. You see? Now that's getting to bother some of you. And you're really getting concerned. And what else did I find out about these people? 88% of them have an off-the-farm business. Sure, one of them bought a bank. And he said, you know what I found out about banking? It's almost as profitable as farming. That's his exact words. 88% of the farmers I interviewed had non-farm businesses. Some of them were even on humanities commissions, Lynn. All right. And these people were involved in a lot of things. Why? As one man said, the neighborhood started calling me a land hog when I ended up with 161 quarters of land. They called me a land hog. And he said, I had to do something with the money. He was already supporting the bowling alley in town and financing 17 teams just so the town would take the heat off of him. Yeah. And so you know what the poor guy did? He started buying oil wells. At the time I interviewed him, he had 65 producing wells, and he wrote me about 6 months ago, and he said, "Hi, I got 106 now." Yeah, he's a land hog, so he had to stop buying land. But he said, but you know, he's got a problem. He's got a problem. It's called pyramiding. And pyramiding ends up with a problem, because you know what the Internal Revenue told me once? They said, "If we don't get you now, we get you when you punch your toes up." You bet your boots. And that's where I told the people in North Dakota at Northwest Farm Managers in February, I said, that's where the Farmers Union have done the greatest damage to the state of North Dakota when they caused the people to throw out the Corporate Farm Act. And I said it right in front of a couple of the people who promoted it. And I think about half the staff of Ag Econ from NDSU were there. And I know what they were thinking, but they didn't dare to express it because they're paid by those same legislators. You done the greatest service, disservice to the North Dakota farmers you could, because you undermined one of the basic avenues of them retaining their farm. And now you talk about wanting to raise the minimum level to $200,000 so you can hold your estate. Well, that's pretty nice. I've spent 2 years working with attorneys trying to figure out the same thing. You see, you got them into a trap. And now you want to snap it on him. And now you want to snap it on him. Don't be so worried about that boogeyman. There is nobody that's going to drive the family-oriented farm off the map. Nobody going to drive a husband and wife team off the map. I know so many of you. And I got the feeling, my God, if you got the right wife, you can do anything. You might like to know. What are my 5 M's of agriculture? And I'm not being facetious now because I'm laying it on the line. The 5 M's of agriculture in least importance first, and the most important one last as I mention them. Mechanization, money, management, motivation, mother. Who saved the family homestead in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and 10 and 20 and 30? It's the woman who gave up everything to save that farm. It's the woman who prodded the man. It's the woman in my case who went along with me to bank and told the banker, "You can force us into bankruptcy, but I will not sign off." Now, none of you have had that happen, but I have. Twice. And I'm proud to say it because it's made me a better man. And I'm not stopping yet. It's the woman and the man together, with the proper motivation, are excellent managers who can show the bank where they've been and where they intend to go, will get all the money they need. There is no shortage of money for agriculture if the farmers make up their mind that they're willing to pay the price that the rest of the industry does to get it. And with money, you can buy consultants. One 39-year-old man I interviewed had 4 PhDs on his staff, all hired away from ag colleges, not hired away as fresh graduates. And you can buy mechanization, and you just look at Walter Ross's farm over here at Fisher, Minnesota. Walter Ross is producing beets at 1/20th of the labor requirements now that he did in 1927 when he won the record for being the most efficient beet producer in the Red River Valley. He's standing sitting right over there. And he's going to go one step further because, as I'm saying in my chapter on the books, every time social legislation comes along that makes it a little bit tougher, the farmer finds out a way to eliminate the man with a hoe. That the social legislation that established the minimum $47 an acre for hoeing beet land is the surest way to get electronic beet trimmers on America there is, on American land there is. So once again, social legislation will take care of the problem because it will eliminate it by eliminating the job. And the Texans can stay in Texas. You see, And I knew that happened. I said, don't get all upset by this legislation, because it'll take care of itself, because they went after 10 and 11 and $12,000 and $16,000 electronic beat tenders just like that the minute the legislation was passed. That's fine. That's fine. We do it all the time. We do it all the time, and we did it this time now. Now let's tell you something else, because I know that some of you want to take some pot shots at me. And let me tell you something. You know what? What I found out about every one of these farmers I interviewed? Nobody likes them. No more than they like college professors who write books, who farm, and go out and speak about it. And especially when they're so darn outspoken, you know. I could have been in the United States Senate race right now if I had given the word. But I said, a guy like me will never win. Because I only speak out of the center of my mouth. You see? And it would have been a fun race. But oh my God, Washington. If that had been a possibility. Who knows? Well, let's go on. What about these people? Nobody likes them. And so I went around the country to find out, why doesn't anybody like them? And first I went to the sociology department. Then I went to the psychology department. And I got my answers before I went back to the farmers. You know why nobody likes them? Because they are change promoters. And most people just can't stand change. And I'll tell you, if you want to get your belly full of the good old days, I'll give you the route that I just took through North Dakota and Montana, through all these little old towns, and then I'll ask you, which one do you want to live in? Which one do you want to live in? Like one farmer said, death, taxes, and change are the three absolutes in life. Change is the only one I have any control over. And that man also ended up, said it's the easiest way to make $1 million I ever found. Now, he's retired now, but that's the way he went. And he wasn't a big farmer, he was only 700 acres. But he was doing a pretty good job. Nobody likes him, so I went from one place to another. I'd go to the newspaper man first. Media always got a pretty good idea. Sometimes they're even objective. And I went to the newspaper man first and I said, what is it that nobody in this community likes about this guy? He gave $50,000 to the ballpark. He's more active in church than anybody I know. He's a real promoter in civic. Yeah, they say that's because he's made it all on us and now he wants to try to be nice and give a little bit of it back. But you know what? The newspaper men usually gave me the objective. They said they can't stand these people. They can't stand these people because they are the advocates of change. Bob Garst in Coon Rapids, Iowa, went down and talked to one of the people. Paper there, I'm writing about this in the book, so I'm not spilling anything on you. And I said, what do you think about Bob Garst? Oh, that darn outspoken guy. He's always doing something. He's even selling to the Russians. You know, even selling to the Russians. Well, good. That got rid of those price-depressing grain bins on us. And we emptied those bins, farmers finally lived again. Okay. And then I said, ma'am, do you think that I would be in Coon Rapids, Iowa, if Bob Garst weren't here? And she said, of course not. There wouldn't be any Coon Rapids. He's the biggest employer in town. 175 people work for him right in town, and then he has another 35 working on his farms. Of course not. There wouldn't be any Coon Rapids. That brings me to another point. Some of you guys think that I'm trying to drive rural America right out of rural America. Further from the thing. We got more things going to us than ever before. I got a boy who wants to farm, and I'm doing everything I can to help him get going down the line after 5 years beyond high school. Then I said, I'll start helping you. Up till that time, I'm just encouraging you to keep farming up most in your mind. Why have we got more going from us than ever before? Because everybody needs us three times a day. Who's everybody? 1/4 of the world eats something grown in America every day. Did you know that? Did you know that 900 million people eat something grown in America every day? Here's two people right here that can prove it. by our exports. I didn't say full meals, but something. And we're all overstuffed with 3,300 calories. So you see, there could be more of them that could eat if we really wanted to be charitable and give it away. But of course, that's another problem. And then the other thing, there is no other industry in the United States that is competitive worldwide as the free enterprising, family-oriented farm is to the rest of the farmers of the world. Why, we can outproduce African and Asiatic farmers 75 to 1. There wasn't a farmer that I was interviewed who was afraid of going on the free market. They were just hoping for the chance. And they were just hoping they could keep the bunglers out of it. And as a pal of mine in Washington says, and this, of course, will irritate some of you too, his name is Butts, says, the only good thing the farmers got going for them as far as Washington, D.C. right now is that the politicians can only do half as much to them as they'd like to. And when we emptied the bins, we proved that. We proved that. I told you I'd irritate some of you. But remember, another thing. We got clout. We've got clout in agriculture like we've never had. And all we need is all the people who are in agriculture should be working with us. You know who all the people are? Everybody on this faculty ought to be working with us. Everybody downtown in Crookston ought to be working with us. Everybody at Steiger ought to be working for us. Everybody at Versatile ought to be working for us. Everybody at International ought to be working for us. Everybody at Chemgrow, at Northland, at Standard Oil. All ought to be backing agriculture because it takes 7 people off the farm to keep 1 man going on the land. We represent 30% of the labor force of America, but only 2% of us are farmers. Now, why don't the rest of them see it? We got a stronger rural America than ever, but that doesn't mean a town of 135 people of Meriden, Minnesota, where I grew up on, where I peddled milk in a bicycle sidecar. No, but there's Owatonna, there's Waseca, there's Fisher, there's Crookston, there's Grand Forks, there's East Grand Forks, there's Thief River Falls. Hallock, viable, mid-sized, rural American communities. Note, I did not say small town. I said viable, mid-sized, rural American communities. They are all agriculture, and they ought to all be working with us. Now, maybe I irritated some of you, but never forget, you haven't got a single person in this crowd who more firmly believes in the family-oriented farm than I am. Thank you.
Hiram Drockey, Baker, Minnesota farmer, author, professor of history at Concordia College Moorhead, and as he says, a strong advocate of rural America. He spoke July 15th at a conference on rural America held on the University of Minnesota Crookston campus. Following Drockey's presentation, I spoke with him and began by asking him about his strong feelings regarding the Homestead Act.
The homestead really caused a tremendous amount of suffering. I know that we look at it and you can see a tremendous family strength, which is a nice byproduct of that. But if you really study the history and you look at what the people went through, whether it's in northern Minnesota or whether it's out in on the hot, searing prairies of the Dakotas, or whether it was in the drought-parched areas of Wyoming or Montana in these particular areas, we legislated people to 160 acres of land, and there was no way they could make a living on that. And this was part of the strange part of this is part of the strange phenomenon of history, because obviously the intent of the Homestead Act was really great. It had a tremendously benevolent thing in mind, but you must also remember that the purpose was to fill up these wide open spaces with people who are, let's face it, taxpayers and productive citizens. This is what makes a strong country. And the suffering that these people had to go through, because they all had great dreams and visions about owning a farm, but a very, very, very large portion of all the homesteaders never did have a farm of their own, because they had to give up before the 5 years. They just couldn't take through. I don't want to downgrade the homestead. I don't, having about a warm feeling towards that, anything else, very definitely. It was a democratization process. There's no doubt about it. It came at a right time. It hastened the development of America. And with the technology available, I suppose, when it started in 1862, it was probably very well thought of. But then when we changed and we came across this area, we didn't have enough possibility of making a decent living. And this is the terrible problem. I'm doing a history of northern Minnesota right now, International Falls area. And the biggest trap that these people got into was to come up there to International Falls and hope they could make a living on 160 acres. It lured them there. It was the bait, but it didn't produce. That was the problem.
Dr. Drocke, what is your definition of a good, efficient family farm?
Well, let's go back. Let me use the term of a banker friend of mine who I'm citing in one of my next books. And in this particular case, the banker feels that a family farmer is entitled to $12,000 a year net income for his family. And so then he says that the farm unit must be big enough to net $12,000. All right, let's just say you're milking cows. If you're milking cows and you're in a pretty decent area, you maybe can get by with 320 acres if you can produce enough forage on that farm for enough cows to produce $12,000 net income. Well, if you're having a $600-$700 income, gross income per cow, and then you take your expenses off of it, how many cows do you need to produce 12,000? If you're a grain farmer, now this has changed a lot in the last few years, but prior to, say, 1972, a lot of grain farmers, the net income of their land was really almost the government payment. Or maybe if they were doing $10 an acre, if they were really efficient. All right, how many acres do you need at $10 an acre net profit to make $12,000 a year living? And that would be 1,200 acres. But if you've got some fallow land, obviously we're talking about, we're maybe talking about three sections, which the USDA says, remember, is the optimum size one-man wheat farm, 1,950 acres. So, you see, these things all tie pretty close together. And so some farmers will say, well, I never made $12,000. Well, then I would question them, because I know truck drivers who are making more than $12,000. A lot of school teachers are making more than $12,000. And there are a lot of other people who are taking a lot less risk than farmers making less than $12,000. And in my estimation, there is no reason why a farmer doesn't have every bit as much right to make the viable standard of living that any other segment of our society. I think this day where the farmers got by with one half as much income as the rest of the people in this country do ought to be a thing of the past. I just don't see why we have to expect our farmers to deny themselves that much.
Well, I'm wondering if there isn't a danger in too large a farm. Are we looking, you said in your talk that 4% of the farms are producing 46% of our produce. Is there a danger of a monopoly in produce, food and fiber production?
People are afraid of this, and I have been asked at some conferences where I've spoken in the past, what can I foresee happening? And I just hate to mention this because I am such an avid free enterpriser, and I could almost visualize agriculture being placed into the whole picture as a utility. In other words, well, we might regulate it, and see, in the past we sort of regulated through the price support programs. We've minimized the opportunity to a degree to a lot of people because basically what we did is guaranteed a certain level of efficiency in farming, and those men could make a living. The rest of them kept dropping by the wayside. All right. Now we've got people who are very much capital-oriented, very much management-oriented, and doing an outstanding job, and they can get quite large. But, Dennis, remember in my talk today, I said that one of the strong factors in the other direction is a very antagonistic community attitude, simply because these are successful people. None of the farmers I interviewed was immune to this. They all felt, because don't we all basically like to be liked?
Is there no upper limit to the size of farms? Could farms keep getting bigger and bigger, buying out more and more neighbors until one's the size of North Dakota?
Jokingly, some people have said that, and of course there is a very obvious upper limit. The upper limits are not as small as many people might like to think. Because we must remember one thing, as your farm becomes larger and as you spread out, you have an insurability factor in there like you don't have on a small farm. Because anybody who travels through the country knows that the weather changes dramatically every 50 miles. And It changes maybe every 3-4 miles. I know I have land today that is producing a real good crop, and I have other land that is producing a very marginal crop, and I have some land that is producing basically no crop right now, just on my rather limited size operation. And that's because we're spread out a little bit, and I see the strength of that. Many people say, well, you can't be this spread out. But if you're well spread out and you're well mechanized, and enough studies have been made on this, the units have to be large enough in themselves. So when you go down, let's say you start from the south and you work to the north, that your south unit's got to be big enough to keep you busy, and then your natal unit, and then your north unit, or things like this. And a lot of them are actually practicing this type of farming.
How many farms do you foresee in the nation in the year 2000?
I foresee a continuance of a large number of hobby farm, moonlight farms, part-time farms, or whatever you want to call it. And it may, that number may even grow, Dennis. It could even grow. We've got 1.23 million of those right now, something like that. And we could have more as more and more, well, let's name it airline pilots. Some airline pilots south of the Twin Cities who have farms. Okay, and so they've got a couple of days off a week. They can go out there and take care of their farm. Or other people who work in factories, and they like to work after the 5 o'clock bell is over, and they do this. And I know a great number of people who do exactly this type of thing. And they will maybe continue this until they probably get to the point that they don't care for it, but then another generation will come along, and they want to do this very thing. See, this is freedom. The freedom to lose your shirt, or the freedom to live the way you want to, whatever you want to call it. I don't care. And I don't think we should close that opportunity. I think we should leave that open. But when it comes to the real food producer, all right, today we have about 580,000 farms that are producing about 88% of our food and fiber. Okay, we can still reduce that number greatly. In fact, it's real easy for me to say that the commercial farms of this country in the very foreseeable future, and let's say I'm saying the year 2000, could number 250,000. And these people can feed and clothe America, and these are not horrendously large farms. Do you realize, to get to that point, the average cropland of all those farms, let's see, 250,000, would only have to be about 1,400 acres. That's not big, because you got to remember, I was down in Texas yesterday, and I spoke to the Texas PCA people down there. The average size farm in Texas is 156 acres. But I know many farms down there that are in the 15 to 20,000 acre bracket.
I'm wondering if the biggest threat to farming in the future is government. Do you see it that way?
Very much. I think social legislation is the one thing that I get the most butterflies in my stomach about. And see, this is an easy thing to have come about, because remember, politicians will cater to the votes. And the big thing here is simply this, that it's easy to raise the flag of danger. I was going to say the red flag of danger, but maybe that might be a bad connotation, so I better not. But it's easy to raise the flag of danger and say, hey, look at these big boys are enroding on rural America. They're taking over rural America, and they're going to buy up all the land, and then they're going to set the price of food. Well, do you really think so? I don't think so, because I saw what Harry Truman did way back in his day to U.S. Steel. And I've seen what a lot of other presidents can do. And so I have no fear of ever this getting away. Plus, we've got to remember, too, that we only have so many people in our society who are willing to take the risk to get to the size that you're talking about. We have a large number, and I'm afraid the number is growing greater every day in our society, of people who have a great aversion to risk. They do not want to take risk, and hence they're satisfied to take a job that pays them a paycheck every day, and they don't want to go farm. In fact, I know a farmer recently who sold his farm because he said, my sons all want to see a paycheck there on Monday morning from the previous week.
What kind of person is that who will take that risk? Who is that manager?
He is a motivator, he is an innovator, and he is a challenge seeker. Now, many people are going to say, oh, well, all the guys you innovated are just money hungry. This is not true. This is not true. They are not money hungry people. There were three of them who I felt, out of all of my interviews, who absolutely were obsessed by the dollar. But most of these people were very sound, family-oriented people. They did a lot with their family, spent a lot of time with them. They worked as a solid unit. The wife was a strong factor in this whole thing. And Like one man told me, he said, well, I wanted to buy this million-dollar farm, but I wasn't sure until my wife somehow or another suspected that I wanted to buy it, and she said, well, go ahead. Go ahead, see? Because he was holding back because he said, well, what if we go bad on it? Then the family will have to suffer. And she said, well, we can take it.
Are you optimistic about the future of farming? It obviously has to perpetuate itself, but are you optimistic about the future of farming as you would like to see it happen?
I'm excited about farming. I'm in farming, and we're developing ours every day, and really, production-wise, I'm expanding more vertically than I am horizontally because I don't think you have to be all over the map to do a really good job. I'm excited about that. But then, one thing, Dennis, and I'd never want anybody to misread me on this, I am cautiously optimistic about the future of farming. Now here is why the caution. First of all, the question that you asked me previously. I am concerned about social legislation, which will be unreasonable, which will affect the farmer. I am also concerned to a degree about maybe some unreasonable environmental regulation. Now, don't read me wrong again. I am a conservationist, and I believe we've got to practice some very definite environmental regulations. But I wished we had more people more knowledgeable about what they're talking about than some of these people who are in the business that are doing it. And then, of course, I have another very definite feeling about it, and this hurts, and this is within us as farmers ourselves, and that is we have such latent potential to overproduce. We still have that right here. And if for some reason or another the rest of the world wouldn't continue to buy from us because of a catastrophe or something like this, I'm not worried about their overproduction because basically they haven't got that potential. And they've got too many people to feed for too long a period of time. But in the short run, we could have some disastrous years simply because of our tremendously prolific farmers.
Hiram Drockey, one of the participants in a conference on rural America, held July 15th through the 17th in Crookston, Minnesota. I'm Dennis Hamilton.